Welcome to the Air Force Agency in Focus, sponsored by Leidos.
The Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics Shop, the ATL, at the Air Force has been on a tear to modernize and speed things up. As the Assistant Secretary for ATL, Dr. William Roper, told me when I visited him at the Pentagon, there's a larger purpose to more effective acquisition.
Acquisition reform is really about trying to be competitive against the threats that we face, and it's a very different century in the 21st than it was in the 20th. So we have a lot of things that we have to change. One of them is how we work with tech startups and small businesses. So historically, the department has done contracting at a very slow pace. And that was fine during the Cold War when we were working with large defense industrial companies, when technology was mainly created on government nickel and it didn't change very quickly. So it would often take a decade to make a huge technology leap ahead. And many of the ones that were made in the Cold War, the internet, satellites, things that we often tout as big defense successes, GPS is one in the Air Force, those were slow moves in a very strategic game of chess with the Soviet Union. Well, fast forward to this century, technology is changing all the time. So the acquisition system can't wait on new technologies to be developed inside the government. We need to be able to rapidly incorporate technologies wherever they're created. And increasingly, that's in the burgeoning tech startup ecosystem that this country and the world is currently enjoying. Well, our contracting process on its best days would take 2 months to award to a small business. And we'd be high-fiving ourselves, saying how lightning fast we are and how mavericky we're being in the contracting world. Where for a company that's small enough, 2 months may be the difference between whether you make payroll or not. And so we wanted to take that 2 months all the way down to a single day, get the contracting length down to a half page, something you could read and understand what you're getting into because it should be in plain English, and get the speed at which we could put you on contract and pay you to minutes. And what we did in New York was our calling card to the tech startup world, that we care about them, that we want to do business at a pace of relevance for them, and that we don't want to just be a purchaser from them. We want to be a partner with them. We want to help them become successful, not just in selling to the Defense Department, but in being dual use, selling to us and then to the rest of the world, and we can be a strategic partner in achieving that. So what we did in New York is had 60 companies come in, and we awarded to 51 of them in less than 15 minutes on average. And that was not just awarding, it was awarding and having money in their bank accounts. And we did that using government credit cards. So we were swiping on square readers and other electronic transaction devices and had a lot of great support from U.S. Bank to push back on the fraud alerts that we were triggering in New York after we had all of these 50,000, 100,000 transactions that occurred one after another.
Well, let me just ask you here, though, because the use of a government credit card is a normal thing when you're buying any kind of commodity, if you need new copy or paper or whatever the case might be. The difference here was from whom you were buying and what you were buying. And how are you able to vet that that's what the Air Force really needed? If you're buying a commodity like copy paper, no doubt what you're getting and who you're buying it from. But in this case, how did you vet the companies? There must have been some prior process before you could get to that 1 hour exchange.
Sure. No, government credit cards are used to buy things that are considered pretty ordinary, as you point out. Well, buying cutting edge ideas needs to be ordinary for us today. So we did our homework on the companies. We made sure that they're U.S.-based. We made sure that we thought they were viable, that they had a good idea, so that when we invited them to come pitch to us, they had already cleared our good enough to get through the gate criteria. But once they got into pitching to us live, we were really scrutinizing their ideas. So the company had already passed muster. Now we want to understand about the idea. And the thing that I learned from doing the pitch events is that when you're buying ideas, which is a different thing for the acquisition system to do, we buy products and services in the old model. Now we need to buy ideas. If you're not just buying the idea, you're buying the team too. And so as companies pitched us on their team, their management, their technical expertise, it was important for us to believe that they had the experience to achieve the idea they were pitching, but also the energy, the enthusiasm to be able to push through what's going to be a difficult uphill climb to productize it in a way that they could sell to us or to commercial industry. And so in future, I hope that we'll use whatever resource we have, government credit cards, contracts, agreements, whatever is the fastest way to get companies like that working with us, and that in future, the idea of the Air Force being a large purchaser of interesting ideas that could change the future technology landscape, for people to think that's just ordinary business for the Air Force.
When you buy an idea, you're not getting ownership of the intellectual property. I don't think any company would do that. You're not buying their patents if they have them. So give me an example of an idea that you bought, and how would that translate into a capability or
sure.
a service that you need?
And you point out an important point. More and more, we're going to own less and less IP, because the idea of the government owning it immediately kicks us out of working with companies that have commercial ambitions. So we've got to have a different business model that's a partnership model in this century. And so I'll give a specific example, and at the end we can round out what that might mean for other companies. So one of the companies at Pitch Day pitched the idea of having artificial intelligence analysis of data as a service that we could use. So we would pipe down data, images, video feeds. We would use their artificial intelligence tools to look at pattern of life, change detection, and those would be output to us as a service. Well, that's a great model for us to pursue with a variety of companies. I don't need to own your box as long as your box is giving me great value at a great rate. And when it's not, I'm going to terminate that initiative and shift to whoever is leading the market at that point in time. So one thing that I think will be true in a lot of areas with commercial startups is we're not going to need to own their product. We just want to own it as a service and use the fact that they have commercial ambitions to help keep their prices down and keep their impetus to innovate up.
And going with that example of AI as a service, which is easy to see where that would be of value to the Air Force and the drone data, and it goes on and on. Now, that let's presume that company also may have a client, say VDOT, Virginia Department of Transportation, may have a need for data analysis, and so might a grocery store chain, but so might also Russia or Russian television. What's the mechanism to make sure that they can have all the commercial development they want and dream of, but that it also gives the Air Force at some point something that the enemy doesn't have?
So there are two things we're going to have to manage in this century. One is the restrictions process that we use to keep critically developed weapons or national security technology from globalizing, from being sold to countries that we don't want it sold to. And the other is being a faster adapter of technologies that will be available to everyone. And so for things that we're developing that we consider to be unique or at least first entry to market on the Defense Department nickel, we'll probably be working in the more restrictive space. But in the case of AI as a service, there's so many companies working that. And so if we apply the same Cold War model, we're going to be behind. And so the thing I'm pushing in the Air Force is for us to be the fastest adapter and adopter of commercial tech, especially technology like artificial intelligence that is not going to be driven under Defense Department dollar. It is going to be globally available. And so right now, the rules that govern working with small businesses for many of our accounts force us to work with only U.S. companies, and we want to prefer them to give our company, our industry base, a competing edge. But if we can't work with companies worldwide, then we'll fall behind as well. So this is just the first step on really changing how we, the Air Force, work in a global ecosystem of commercial technology and ensure that if you can buy something personally and have it on your phone today, that it's available for our warfighters that fast.
That's William Roper, the Air Force Assistant Secretary for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics. More of the interview after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
Artificial intelligence is often portrayed as a magic wand that will solve everything. But in reality, unlocking the power of AI comes from looking beyond the hype and focusing on thoughtful and realistic problem solving. At Leidos, we're focused on helping our customers adopt AI and machine learning tools with solutions that solve real problems. With a deep understanding of our customers, we're creating reliable, resilient, and secure solutions that look beyond the hype. Learn more at Leidos.com/AI.
Welcome back to our interview with William Roper, the Air Force Assistant Secretary for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics. I'm Tom Temin. In this segment, I asked him about the differences between the earlier generation of competitive offset and the one he's pursuing now.
There are still technologies that we need to be able to develop inside the government. Stealth is one of them. We're not likely to get that anytime soon from commercial industry, though if that changed, we would have to change our model to be a fast adapter.
People would paint their cars with it or something.
Yes, it would be definitely a way to beat the radar gun. So let's go back to the Cold War and the offset that was done. You know, the Air Force was the ultimate recycler of systems. We took functionality that we could have put in weapons and lost every time we used them, and we put them in places that we could recycle them weapon after weapon. We put detection of targets in space. We put navigation in space through GPS. We put stealth on our airplanes so that they could go in and drop weapons time after time again without being shot down. The only part that we wasted, waste in quotes, was the weapon. You can't reuse that. So we call that parasitic. So that was the shift that we made. Every one of those technologies, satellite-based intelligence, satellite navigation, stealth, are hard. They're driven by materials. They're driven by electronic advances. And that was during a period where it took a lot of money to develop technology. Only governments could develop world-changing technologies. Now anyone can. The things that are changing the world have shifted from materials and electronics, though that's still a big player, to software. So software literally eating the world. And now the companies that are moving and shaking in software are not hoping to be defense primes. They're hoping to be the next big Amazon, Facebook, Google. And so if you're in the Air Force and looking at our accounts, so the billions that we have to work with small businesses, how would we engage a company like that? Well, early on, there are a lot of ways. We can make our resources available to them because we're not going to ask for equity. You don't have to give up anything to us, ownership in your company, IP. So we should be an easy first partner. The other thing we have is an interesting marketplace. So we're $700 billion a year in terms of our market, and we can pay a price point that is higher than the commercial market can, and we can often operate at an area of risk that's different than the commercial space. So let's take, for instance, self-flying cars. So, you know, I want to see the Jetsons happen on my watch. Those cars are awesome. Where have they been? Think about the challenge of operationalizing something like that domestically, getting through all of the FAA certifications, the safety certifications, versus coming into the Air Force sphere where we can pay a higher price point than our commercial counterparts and we can operate at a different risk profile. You know, why haven't we put ourselves out as a bridging mechanism from someone that has commercial ambitions and wants to get there, and they can walk our defense bridge as one of the paths to achieve it? So that's an area that I'm working with our research lab right now, to look for commercial partnerships where our money's important, but our marketplace equally is.
Yeah, speaking of that marketplace, what you've been talking about in AI, what we've been discussing, is in many ways not a new technology, but just a coming together of a lot of things, algorithms. Thanks to fast computing, you can do things that you couldn't do before. But it's really just coding, software coding. Do you think that the model you're talking about can discover perhaps actually new technologies? Those don't come along as frequently as, because there's probably 200 companies if you wanted to make a list of AI vendors. What about really new technology? Do you think there's a way to ferret that out?
It's too big of a risk to not assume it's true and pursue it as if it is. So you mentioned that AI is driven by software. That's true, but I would also say it's also driven by data. So true. AI is really good software and algorithm practices that have access to unprecedented amount of data and the ability to process it quickly. And so if you step back and you look at the Defense Department, our approach to dealing with data is still very old school. We view data as a byproduct. You know, we went out and we did a mission and we collected data, and that data was useful at the time the human had to make a decision, but we don't view it as having any sustaining value. It's not like a commodity. Well, data has surpassed oil in terms of its value to the world economy. Data is the next big revolution. And we are slow to start putting in a data architecture that treats it more important than the platforms that created it. So one, we have to be able to do that, or we're not going to get the benefit of bringing AI into the department. We can send data out to commercial entities, as we discussed with the AI company. We can have AI as a service, but if we don't have any data to give them, then they can't bring their service to us. So shifting to cloud is a huge push for me right now in the Air Force, getting all of our data in a way that can be discovered easily. And then once it's there, then it opens up the ability to start doing interesting things in the area of research that you mentioned. So AI is everywhere. If I were going back to school right now, there wouldn't be a single area I could think about being a scientist or an engineer where AI wouldn't be involved. So it'll be quantum science, but also with AI, material science with AI, medicine with AI. It's just allowing pattern recognition that the human can't do. And so it's too big of a risk for us to assume that in future when we're designing that next stealth plane that it won't be stealth with AI, and not just AI for the design. We may have to have AI on the plane to take advantage of whatever it recommends that we do. So we're working on our sixth-gen aircraft right now, and now is a really interesting time to put on your science fiction hat and imagine what the future of air power would be. But we're discussing not just traditional military technologies like stealth. We're bringing these commercial ones to the table and asking what opportunities do these pose in future, what challenges, and then how do we get the best of both worlds? So your question is a really important one, because you're thinking of AI not just as an end-state product. You're thinking of it as an enabler for many products, and we need to do that more broadly in the department.
That's William Roper, the Air Force Assistant Secretary for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics. More of the interview after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
Artificial intelligence is often portrayed as a magic wand that will solve everything. But in reality, unlocking the power of AI comes from looking beyond the hype and focusing on thoughtful and realistic problem solving. At Leidos, we're focused on helping our customers adopt AI and machine learning tools with solutions that solve real problems. With a deep understanding of our customers, we're creating reliable, resilient, and secure solutions that look beyond the hype. Learn more at Leidos.com/AI.
Welcome back to the third part of our interview with William Roper, the Air Force Assistant Secretary for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics. I'm Tom Temin. In this segment, I asked him about some down-to-earth matters.
And looking more prosaically, because you are the Assistant Secretary for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics, you've also spoken about shortening the acquisition end-to-end cycle for things that may not be all that groundbreaking, but because there's so much bureaucracy and cost involved. What are your thoughts there? What are your plans there?
We've made a lot of pushes, and I would say we've gotten the easy parts done first. So the whole push for me is to make the Air Force's acquisition system more competitive than any other Air Forces in the world. And if we can't, then we may have great ideas about AI and quantum and other technologies, but if we're not faster in being able to pull them in from commercial industry or develop them ourselves and get them fielded, then we may win for a while, but we're ultimately losing because the pace at which we make moves is slower than our enemies. First thing that I did when I came in is say, I know we're risk adverse. I know that the Pentagon tells program managers that cost is king, so don't have any money be wasted. But if you're totally focused on cost, you're not focused on time. Our industry counterparts would tell us time to market's everything. So we shifted the major metric in acquisition to time is everything. Now, that'll mean that we'll operate at a little higher price point in most cases because we will spend more money to reduce risk earlier so that we field on time. Well, that's prototyping. That's fly before you buy, which is a Packard principle from 1970. So we're finally living up to what Packard told us to do in 1971, which is focus more on time than cost. If we focus primarily on cost, we'll lose with money in our pockets. So,
or you'll have a system like the F-35, which is both untimely and overpriced.
Yeah, it's funny that we've said fly before you buy so often in the department, but we rarely do that. We like to fly something and then go buy something else. So I have asked the Air Force to make prototyping the first and foremost way in which we approach acquisition. Let's actually go fly before we buy. Two, let's embrace risk. Let's not put margin in our schedule. And I asked every program to go back, and if they had margin in their schedule for risk tolerance, I asked them to cut it out. Take out unnecessary steps, analysis, paralysis, take it out, and let's tally up how much time that equates to across the Air Force. That ended up being over 100 years in the first year that I was in office. So 100 years of flex or slack. That was indicative of a conservative approach to acquisition, which is not what you want if you're trying to compete. So, Tom, view our first step is trying to get where we're temporarily focused and there's no slack in our schedule. But if we're going to speed up faster, we're not going to do it by continuing to tailor. We've done the majority of that. Now we've got to be smarter in what we do. So we've got two big pushes here, and these are big things. We've made huge strides in one. We've got to make strides in the next. One is how quickly we develop software. This has been the wonderful, easy button for me since being in the Air Force. I thought this would be truly hard to get the Air Force where it could do code, and organizations like Kessel Run and Kobayashi Maru and Bestman, these are software factories. You can go out and see airmen wearing T-shirts or hoodies, depending on time of year, writing quality code that goes from the warfighter sitting right beside them, telling the coder what he or she needs, to doing operations on the battlefield weeks later. Weeks, not years. I thought this would be hard. This has been so much easier than I thought. We have thousands of airmen writing quality code today, bringing in modern practices like Kubernetes and cloud that are long overdue in the department.
And by the way, that's a return to the future, because up until the late, I would say, 90s, there was the push to get rid of all blue-shirted, if you will, coding and go commercial.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that we have to have all code done by airmen, but we have a lot of airmen who are good at coding, so that should be something we allow them to do for their career. We've created a career track for software coding. We give salary credit for foreign language if that foreign language is a coding language in addition to languages.
How long has that been the case?
Only started about 4 or 5 months ago. Okay. So that's a new initiative that we and our A1 and MR counterparts that work personnel said, why do we not value this? We value it in the Air Force. Why does our salary incentive structure not reflect it? So we've made a great push in getting airmen where they can code, working on systems from Air Operations Center. We're redoing the F-35 logistics system called ALICE, and that team named themselves Mad Hatters. So there's a little tongue-in-cheek there.
Well, because it has been something of a rabbit hole, you might say.
And what has ALICE not benefited from are these modern software techniques. I do think that we're a little guilty of talking to the world and saying we need to do agile software development, and the world hears doing it faster. And what's very different about modern software techniques is it's just really good lean manufacturing process applied to coding, which did not exist in the 70s, 80s, 90s. We have a whole Air Force that's trained to think of lean process in manufacturing. And lean in manufacturing means you're doing things like quality all across your production line. Quality is not a station at final assembly. Quality is in every person responsibility. Well, modern coding tools allow things like quality, how many bugs do you have in your code, to be done all across the coding line, not at the very end, quote, final assembly step. It also allows security to be done that way. It allows testing to be done that way. It makes them a service in the pipeline. So when you shift to those tools, you speed up, because things that usually took a lot of time at the end are happening in little chunks all along the way. Well, take that and bring in Agile DevSecOps best practices like coding with your user, doing rapid deployments, getting deficiencies quickly retired as opposed to doing monolithic software drops, and you're in a completely different world where the tools and the process take people that could have tried to struggle under the waterfall system and just put them in an environment where they're much more likely to succeed because the errors don't grow. And so that has been much easier than I thought. The challenges we have now are, how do you get that software certified? Just because I wrote it, how do I know it's safe? And it might be fine if you're starting on things like a planning tool or an image processing tool, but what happens when I need to put it in an airplane and there's a safety constraint? So testing is a big area we've got to up our game. Haven't even mentioned bringing artificial intelligence in, which we're currently working. You know, how do I put artificial intelligence in the cockpit? Well, it changes every time you use it. So what are you certifying? You're not certifying the code, because that changes every time. You've got to be certifying the environment of the code.
William Roper, the Air Force Assistant Secretary for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics. To hear this interview again or to share it, go to federalnewsnetwork.com. Search Agency in Focus. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to the Air Force Agency in Focus, sponsored by Leidos on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.